Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud, the podcast of Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon Thought. I'm Farah Sneddon, Personal Voices Editor at Dialogue. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Lori Lee Hall, whose essay in the spring 2026 issue, Eternal Identity Misunderstood, A Transgender Woman's Journey Through Faith, Revelation, and LDS Policy, offers a powerful and deeply personal reflection on faith, identity, and belonging. Lori Lee Hall is an architect and former senior leader in the church's temple design and construction program. She has written and spoken about her experiences as a transgender woman of faith, reflecting on the intersections of identity, spirituality, and institutional life. I'm going to introduce Lori, and just to give you a little idea of who she is and the work that she does, by quoting a Nathan Kitchen Facebook post that he put up on March 31st, the Transgender Visibility Day. So here it is. On this day of transgender visibility in 2020, Atlantic Magazine writer McKay Coppins was granted an interview with the president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Russell M. Nelson, to explore the church's bicentennial birthday. The Deseret News called the article, quote, the most consequential magazine-length feature on The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in more than a decade. Here is the rest of that story. The photo that accompanied Coppins' article was the Okura Mountain Temple, the design and construction of which was directed by Lori Lee Hall, the former chief architect of temples for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Despite her breathtaking buildings, physical icons, and a church connecting heaven to earth, Lori was forced from her position for no other reason than that she was a transgender woman. Recalling that moment, Lori shares, quote, there was a time when I could totally relate to Moses in the classic movie, The Ten Commandments, when Sethi said, quote, let the name of Moses be stricken from every book and tablet, stricken from all pylons and obelisks, stricken from every monument of Egypt. Let the name of Moses be unheard and unspoken, erased from the memory of men for all time. Quote, attempts were also made to eliminate my name, my voice, and any connection to my work and service within the church, says Lori. However, time has shown that just as my efforts will not be erased, transgender persons within and without the church will never be erased. We are valid, worthy individuals who make enormous contributions to the communities to which we are able to belong. Serving with Lori, this is Nathan Kitchen speaking, serving with Lori and Affirmation's executive committee, I noted that as senior vice president of Affirmation, Lori brought her talents, discarded by the church, to build and connect LGBTQIA+ souls, their families, and friends who take shelter under the house she helped build in Affirmation. Thank you, Lori, writes Nathan. You and your voice will not be erased. Lori, that's pretty heady stuff from Nathan there. Are there some things about yourself you might want to share?
Well, first, I have to always thank Nathan for being one of my greatest promoters. That was a wonderful piece, and to have it reappear again this year was really fun. And we all reposted it, and I saw lots of other people share it. So it's valuable, particularly as we just experienced the Transgender Day of Visibility, to still have a voice and to be recognized as a contributor in the overall conversation and dialogue with regard to this intersection that I have lived in for a very long time. I think a theme that came out in my memoir that was published in 2024, Dictates of Conscience, I think a theme that came through was that the church did attempt at least to distance themselves from me and my work for them, if not truly silence me. And over time, you know, once the initial shock and horror of that passed, over time it became very much a part of who I was to not be silenced, to not be erased, to be able to speak and write and give interviews such as this, that remind the church community that's trying to pretend we don't exist, or somehow through policy that we'll talk about in a bit and so forth, make it so that we cannot exist in their circle, to remind folks that there are good, faithful Latter-day Saints and Latter-day Saint adjacent transgender and non-binary individuals of faith who would gladly participate and be a part of the gospel, the larger gospel in general, and maybe even Latter-day Saint communities, were it not for certain commitments and decisions made on the part of the senior brethren at this time.
Well, I absolutely agree with your statements there. And I really do believe that it's a privilege to have you here on Dialogue Out Loud today. And I want to thank you for that, for being willing to talk about this and for sending in this article that appears in the April Spring issue. And you mentioned your book, and I'm wondering about that too. Again, the name of Lori's memoir is Dictates of Conscience, From Mormon High Priest to My New Life as a Woman. That came out in 2020. Does this essay, it's right in front of me, 2024. Does your essay and dialogue come from your experiences writing your memoir? Is that part of what is in the book?
It's not a synopsis or a summary of what's in the memoir, but the article is really an advancement of my thinking in the roughly year that occurred from the time the manuscript was submitted for publication, and another year of water and legislation and turmoil under the bridge, wanting to maybe represent my state of mind, you know, as of last fall, as opposed to a year before.
That's wonderful. I didn't realize that. I'm really glad that you were able to share your evolving feelings and understandings of all of this. And I want to start by saying how moving your essay is. It weaves together your personal experiences, your spiritual reflection, and the institutional context in a way that invites readers to both empathize and have deeper understanding of what it may be like for those who are transgender in the church or out of the church, but still wanting to, still feeling like they belong to the LDS faith. You kind of did just tell us about what led you to write this essay. What made you feel like this, or is this a specific kind of moment that makes it important to share this with a larger reading audience?
So I think it's beneficial to go back and think about what happened just as I finished writing the manuscript for my memoir in the summer of 2024. I note that in an afterword that I included, that I had completely rewritten when on the morning of August 19th, 2024, the church released a set of policy restrictions aimed at those who, according to their language, had transitioned away from their biological sex assigned at birth. And those restrictions became, for many of us, a final straw in our ability to have a meaningful participation relationship with the church. My publisher, Signature Books, and Barbara Jones Brown and I decided that we were going to scrap what I had written for the afterword and address that issue directly. So that very week, I rewrote the afterword to speak to that exact moment in time. And that became powerful because the book wasn't immediately out of date. It was, you know, pinpoint to the exact time and place, but probably the most significant statements the church has made thus far with regards to those with gender identity differences from the binary, the normative binary. Tickle me again with the thoughts from your question so I can answer it more fully.
What did you feel like your book was meant to do, past telling your own story. What audience were you looking to connect with? What important things did you want to share with people, both inside or outside LDS culture and church? Could you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I knew going in that I had an interesting and unique story that would attract some. I was able to, at one time or another, to do some pretty interesting and meaningful things in the church and with church leaders on a very close level. But that interesting story alone simply became the vehicle, the boat in which we were going to ride down the current of what I was really trying to get after, which was to connect with an audience of particularly Latter-day Saints, to be able to see that although I was excommunicated for apostasy, I'm not an apostate, and that I am still the same person that did all of those admirable things before. And if folks reading the memoir could get to the point where they realize that I am that same person and that I didn't jump off, you know, the precipice of sin, and it would make the telling of what I really wanted to accomplish much more relatable and meaningful. And what I really wanted to accomplish, to finish answering your question, is to make the point very, very clearly and succinctly that gender identity is real, and that the way that you know an individual's gender identity is to ask them and believe them. And relating to the church's current policy restrictions, that sex assigned at birth is not a reliable or meaningful way to determine individual identity. And that issue of gender identity is real is something that's so apparent to those of us who experience gender identity distinct or in conflict with who we were assigned to be at birth, but that I think the general population, they never have to experience or define gender identity. You wake up in the morning, I assume, and never have to ask, who am I today? You know, what am I today? I'm a woman, a wife, a mother, you know, an author, a publisher, or whatever. But for those of us walking in a world that's not designed for us, it was a constant issue of having to say, yeah, this is who I am. This is how I feel. I feel this way painfully strong today. And yet I'm not able to express that. I'm not able to present that. Or folks with authority around me, above me, below me, power structures, whatever it may be, are telling me I'm nuts for thinking that or for feeling that. So outcome, ultimately, whether it was a church audience or a secular audience, folks near and wide, I just wanted to make the point because it seems so basic and essential to the dialogue that's continuing to take place politically and religiously today, that this issue of gender identity is absolutely real. That's supported now by medical science, but medical science isn't often listened to in the political and religious environment or given much credit.
Absolutely. I was thinking the same thing as you were speaking, that for decades we've known that there are a multiplicity of genders based on chromosomes, based on birth. There are different areas in the world that see a much larger trans or not quite matching up female to male kind of thing than other places in the world. This is not something that is new. It's been around for a really long time.
It makes me think that locking into a gender binary that's based upon the opinion of a visual inspection made on the part of a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a birth doula, whomever, of what a baby's appearance seems to be, and locking them in for their life in a definition binary seems to be, quite frankly, medieval in its level of sophistication. It really is a huge generational, if not millennial, step into the past.
Absolutely agree with you. At the same time, in my own space here in Colorado, I've seen more and more of the friends of my children coming out as trans and being absolutely supported in their schools. At the same time, Colorado's bill to ban conversion therapy was overturned just the other day at the Supreme Court. Right. Yep. So there are all these steps going forward, and there's still, of course, all these steps holding us back. I want to ask you, Lori, shift just a little bit and talk with you about what your experience was in the time where you had come out as transgender woman to the authorities of the church, where you still were working on buildings, and what that was like for you in that space where you're still kind of part of the team, but clearly on your way out of that. What was that like for you? Especially, as you say, you still very much have a testimony of Christ and a lot of the tenets of the Mormon faith.
So to set the time frame for those who may not be familiar, this would be the fall of 2012. And coming into the spring and summer of 2013, that I faced a lot of general authority interviews. I name off who those were with and describe in part anyway, what those conversations were like. It was a very risk-filled time. I knew of other examples of individuals who had been identified as gender nonconforming or transgender in church employment, who were immediately on the spot removed from their position and sent out the door. The potential of being fired on any given day was real. Ultimately, those meetings yielded certain constraints that I was expected to live my life by, not just at the church office building, but in all aspects of my life, 24/7, there was always the chance that somehow something would get back to leadership that would disqualify me from being able to continue to be an employee. In the end, I danced through that with them for another 4 years up until 2016. During that time, for another year, I was still leading the design of temples, and then transferred over to other church special projects, which primarily included the Provo Missionary Training Center expansion. And during that time that I worked on Provo MTC, which was a delightful project, a fun project to be a part of, I had actually began my medical transition, and it got a lot easier for me to be me at work, but also started to create this strange dichotomy where I was still putting on the white shirt and tie, but I was very much shifted from that other guy to Lori Lee, but I still had to answer to the other guy's name and responsibilities. But that was me. I was the other guy, and I was becoming more authentic. And in doing so, it was when I wasn't worried about who was going to out me. It was very, very enjoyable for me to participate in my life's work in my authentic state of mind and with my progressively authentic body.
I love that you had that moment. That time to be yourself.
It and was also 2 years. 2014 to 2016. Yeah.
That you love to do. What a gift that was. I imagine that was.
When I did finally leave, it wasn't because I wanted to. It was because their tolerance level for me had reached its peak. I would have continued on for another 10 years if they'd let me just change the name tag on the door and, you know, follow the sister's dress standard.
Yeah. And that wasn't going to happen, huh?
No. And it probably still wouldn't be available. Maybe someday, who knows?
One of the central tensions in the essay that you've written for this April's dialogue is around the idea of paternal identity. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how you've come to understand that concept over time, if that has shifted for you in any way as you have gone through your transitioning to become Lori Lee.
Well, it is an interesting conversation. I describe in the memoir back in the day, and this would be 1995, 1996, when the Proclamation on the Family first came out, there were things about it that really disturbed me at the time, although I was really trying hard as a faithful high priest group leader to anchor to it. There were things about gender roles and so forth that really disturbed and triggered me, sending me into kind of a deep circumstance that I describe. But by the time I started talking with the general authorities in 2012, you know, here another, you know, 15 years later, I had really anchored to the notion as I read it in the Proclamation on the Family, which was still a core document in my mind at the time, that eternal gender identity, stringing together three words in the same sentence, are essential characteristics of who we are, pre-earth life, mortality, and in the hereafter. And I was convinced that was what the church's doctrine was really, was that we existed as spirits, sons and daughters, and that identity was eternal. And I totally accepted that as appropriate in my circumstance as well. And just through the course of some of the things that happen in utero, in the course of mortal birth, some things didn't quite sort out to match my eternal identity. But my sense was that God was totally on board, knowing exactly who I was eternally in pre-earth life and here on earth, and that I was supported in taking whatever steps that were necessary, you know, from a spiritual point of view, to take any steps that were necessary to align more fully with my eternal identity, because that's who I was always going to be in the future. As I would describe that to the brethren and describe my own spiritual witness on that subject, it didn't correlate, obviously, with their reading of it. And ultimately, in 2019, President Oakes came out and said, no, what we mean by gender in the Family Proclamation is biological sex at birth, to which I said at the time to the Salt Lake Tribune, that runs counter to my lived experience, and that's not the identity I have in my own life. I don't believe that definition is either correct or will stand the test of time. And actually, that definition in October of 2019 is the thing the church still trips over in relationship to its gender nonconforming members. Were it not for that, I think we could all be integrated into the church and its programs and teachings in a much more effective way than we've now been excluded.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't look like things would be changing in the near future either. Let's talk for a moment about your faith and your revelation. I can't try to put myself in your shoes in terms of what it must be like to feel deeply committed to the plan of salvation and to Christ, and at the same time not being able to live your life in a way that connects and feels like it meets that because of the strictures that are being that were being placed on you at the time. What are your ideas around eternal identity? And how has maybe has that concept changed for you in the last several years?
Yeah,
you know, that's a really, question.
Yeah, no, it is. But I would answer it from largely from the perspective of how I felt and what I knew and considered that I knew and had received my personal revelation regarding. That hasn't changed. That anchor that I arrived at through careful study and prayer long before I came out to anyone, long before the general authorities figured me out or thought they did, I had to figure it out for myself. I had to reconcile my identity as I came to understand it with God's plan and, quite frankly, God's feeling about the matter. And when I got those reconciled, and that was back in November of 2011, as I describe in the memoir, that became a lock for me. That's my eternal identity. That's who I was. That's who I am. That's where I'm going. And all of that still makes sense, and I have the deepest commitment and faith to it. What actions the church as an institution, as my employer, and also my ecclesiastical leadership, what they did with regard to that were temporal matters as far as I'm concerned, and God wasn't in that. And quite frankly, I felt no pressure as they were pushing me out of employment and then ultimately pushing me out of the church and removing my membership record. I felt no pressure to re-examine my commitment to what I knew. I didn't need to. I knew it. I knew it as well as I know myself and as strong as I felt any spiritual experience in my life. And I've had many. And over time, as I've obviously become distant from regular church participation, that doesn't mean I've lost my spiritual connection to deity. That doesn't mean that I don't still foster a relationship with what Latter-day Saints refer to as the Holy Ghost. And I'll use that term because that feels good to me still. I mention in the book that my middle daughter once asked me, and she's still faithful and a returned missionary and temple worker. She said, "Daddy, can you tell me what it's like to lose the Holy Ghost?" I said, "I don't know, because it's never happened." You know, that's still very much a part of my walk and my experience. And so I didn't leave the church myself. The church left me and left me with the opportunity and responsibility to move through my life according to, here comes the book title, "The Dictates is My Conscience." And in doing so, I think that ultimately for me, hard as it was to get there, became a great gift because I could then, without constraints of the institution, focus on my responsibilities for my spiritual walk and the growth of my faith and the decisions I make about how I serve and who I serve and what I can do to make lives better on earth. And that has been delightful. But certainly no need to go back and readdress or reassess decisions that I came to, you know, through the influence of the Spirit and at a time when I had to really go through the pressure cooker of figuring out what this all meant and what it meant in the big picture of where I belonged in the plan.
Your personal spiritual experiences, of course, came into conflict with the official teachings. And that is the case for many church members, regardless of where they may be on the spectrum of gender. Are there things or are there experiences that you could share with members who may be in that kind of space, whether it is gender or just feeling like the Holy Ghost tells you to do one thing And that is not quite what the church necessarily would have you do. What was that like?
Yeah, I had to, and in my studies through time and even my service in the church and my work with the general authorities and my employment, I had to come to a realization that what was most critical for me and what ultimately I might have conversations with deity about was how I responded to and worked with the light and knowledge that I was given. And where that seems to run counter at times to the institutional church's desire to control its members and to get them to think one way and to support a leadership structure that has an opinion about how the world should be, while at the same time remembering that we were built on a foundation of common consent and of personal revelation and of individuals being able to walk into the woods and receive, you know, light and knowledge that contradicted the world's teachings. All that dissonance of the regiment of, you know, obey this teaching versus seek your own light and knowledge and then act by it. Well, you can see what camp I'm in. I'm very much in the seek my own knowledge in a very diligent way and then confidently proceeding with it, recognizing that if I've come to a satisfactory spiritual answer for myself, it shouldn't be doing harm to others. It shouldn't be reducing someone else's opportunities or rights, but it should be helping make me a better person and a better version of myself, fulfilling the measure of my creation, to use that term. I think I dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's on that. And so when my stake president, for example, said my understanding of certain issues surrounding eternal gender identity were not consistent with the teachings of the Brethren, that didn't rattle me. It's like, yeah, I know that's the case. But and maybe it's bold to say, but the leadership of the church receives general revelation for the church at a level which they're ready themselves as individuals to receive. Careful examination of the removal of the priesthood ban demonstrates that that wasn't going to occur until there was somebody of people in those red seats who was ready to say, this is a change we should make, you know, and then call it a revelation or a confirmation of that decision. But it's not going to come to the unwilling of mind or heart, and the leadership of the church presently isn't there, but there ought to be an acknowledgement that in the case of an individual trying to govern their own life, there should be flexibility for an individual like myself to arrive at a spiritual decision, for lack of a better term, ahead of the Brethren, that and still have enough wiggle room to fit in there and not have it be so restrictive that there is no wiggle room for something that really amounted to my physical, emotional, and spiritual health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that with you. And you, I don't know that you could have said it any better. Speaking to that, you've had to struggle a lot with the church leadership. But what things have been sustaining to you? Where are the things that have the love and the acceptance and the surprising bits of joy that have come from other people? What was that like for you? Have you experienced something like that? Like an outpouring?
In a number of ways. I devoted a chapter of my memoir to a lovely 10-month experience that I had in the little struggling inner city ward in Salt Lake City, the Liberty Ward, and how within a church setting as an excommunicated member, I was loved, and how that portrayed how things ought to be. that was a beautiful moment in time where I still felt like, in contrast to my stake that I had run and the ward where I had presided, who had sent me packing, that this little ward saw me as an individual and experienced love with me, you know. And so that was kind of a chapter that says, hey, here's how church could look, you know, for someone like me. Quite frankly, excommunication it's pretty potent and thorough for what it does. And it pretty well stripped me of a lot of relationships and friends. And so during that first couple years post-excommunication, I lost so many relationships and had to find a whole lot of new relationships. And meeting you was one of those. and a host of other folks who didn't trip over the fact that I was once their priesthood leader, I guess, but saw me as an individual with merit and worth. And so that was all very beneficial. You read just now from a statement introducing me that Nathan Kitchen wrote. Nathan's become a dear friend because he and I served together for the better part of four or five years as in the leadership of Affirmation. And we continue to be friends. We both published our memoirs almost at the same time, telling two sides of the same coin about what it's like to be LGBTQ / LDS or former LDS. My time in Affirmation literally gave me an altar of service where the altar of service had been stripped away, and I couldn't continue to give in the institution where I had for so many years. So Affirmation became for a long time my altar of service and to do some good in the world, literally in the world, because we were taking it out to all corners of the planet at that time. Then COVID hit. And that deepened a whole lot of other relationships. And then starting this process of writing a memoir and speaking about it often and all that, it's just, I've always wanted and needed a place where I could give of myself time, talents, and means. and happily, I've been able to find that journey. It's been very fulfilling. And I feel like it's been doing some good. I get particularly marvelous conversations from time to time, private messages from moms of transgender kids, you know, who are so grateful to have been able to hear or read a portion of my story because they're so worried about what their future for their kiddo is going to look like, and especially in current environment, just to give hope to these families.
You know, I know of many congregations around the United States that welcome transgender women into their pews, there's just a lot of love, you know, and it may not equal in any way the other side of the coin, but there are bishops who let transgender women go into the bathroom of their choice. You know, there are bishops who let transgender women or men bring their partner with them to church. There are places that, with so many more people experiencing loved ones who are trans or have any sort of other gender issue, more and more those loved ones are opening doors in our some of our congregations. What kind of things give you hope, Lori, going forward?
It's hard to answer that question now, harder now than it was 2 years ago. My hope is that we survive until 2028's election. What happened at the federal level in November of 2024 was exactly the thing I noted in the preface of my book, that if the world turned the way that it now has, it was going to get very, very hard for trans people, particularly youth. And that has proven to be exactly what has occurred. And is it as bad as I could have imagined when I was writing that some 3 years ago? What gives me hope is that although many people feel empowered by their political leaders and their church leaders to be downright ugly and bigoted towards trans people, that there are still many people who know better and feel better and choose their better angels to do as you say, to be accepting, affirming, empowering, welcoming, and that so long as that light in those lives doesn't get snuffed out by everything else that's going on, that in the long run, as Nathan and I used to talk about, the moral arc is going to ultimately bend towards inclusion and acceptance of transgender individuals, equal before the law, access to full medical health care, full participation in the congregation, faith congregation of their choice. We're not there yet. And it's almost, it almost seems a little nuts to think that we could get there. But I guess my hope would be that the moral arc does bend, and maybe it bends only a little at a time. Maybe it's kinked because of what's happened lately, but the moral arc, I hope we'll get there.
What if I'm certain that we'll have parents or families reading your essay in dialogue who have children or loved ones who are transitioning or feel like they should be transitioning? What sort of resources would you suggest to them?
Well, the most important thing is, like, say, for example, we're speaking about a parent or parents with a kiddo who comes out to them as having gender dysphoria in congruence with their birth sex identification. As a note, about just under 1% of adults in the U.S. identify as trans, but a full 3% or more of youth identify. That's a significant increase in the youngest generation. And these kids are born into Latter-day Saint families, faithful families, and every other family. So parents do have to address this. Some of my grandchildren will probably have this conversation with their parents at some point. But what's critical, and it hasn't been completely snuffed out, is for that parent or parents to be accepting, because the safety of that young person goes up tenfold from roughly 40-45% of young people that experience suicidal ideation without parental support to the national norm of about 4-5% experiencing those thoughts and feelings. So the first thing is the engagement and really unconditional support and love, which means love without the parent being able to impose their own conditions upon their kid. You know, like I said earlier, recognize that the kid knows best what their gender identity is, and that they need to hear them and believe them and support them. And then to meet with appropriate therapists and pediatricians and others to make up a multidisciplinary team of support to rally around that young person. That's getting hard to find in a lot of states. Some 26 or 27 states have gone down the road of significantly curtailing gender-affirming care for youth. Other states are looking at that. Some places are even thinking about that problem you know, fighting that problem for adults as well. But I don't think anyone yet has managed to completely outlaw a parent and a child showing up at a doctor's office and having a private conversation about this circumstance. And so long as our medical field continues to tap into appropriate vetted known sources of truth medically and can give support to that young person, that support may only be therapeutic and so forth at this point in time, because not a youth in not every state even have access to hormonal support. And to me, having grown up as a young person in a time when none of this was understood, hormones weren't available, and I know how hard that felt. And to think that it's available now and it's being withheld is criminal. Just, it's criminal. But to be able to provide as much support to that young person, hopefully getting them through whatever turmoil they may be experiencing, in addition to being a normal teenager, and getting to reach an age where, you know, the current healthcare system and federal and state laws will allow them to get the full measure of gender affirming healthcare that they would need. And let's not lose any of these kids along the way. But so many community, both political and religious community forces, power centers, if you will, are fighting against this for all the wrong reasons.
Absolutely.
Leaving youth just really vulnerable and potentially unprotected.
Absolutely. And it's a shame and a sin, I think.
History is not going to look back favorably on this moment of time for so many reasons, but this is one of them.
Agreed. Very much agreed. Speaking with you today, Lori, it's always a pleasure, but today to be able to speak with you in such depth has been just a gift to me. And so for that alone, thank you very much for being willing to do this interview with us. I want to remind listeners that Lori's memoir, Dictates of Conscience, From Mormon High Priest to My New Life as a Woman, is available in bookshops and online. Lori, thank you again for your openness and for sharing your story so thoughtfully with us. It has just been an honor.
Oh, thank you so much. Challenging questions that have been fun to talk to.
It's always fun to talk with you.
Thank you
for listening to Dialogue Out Loud. You can find Lori Lee Hall's essay, Paternal Identity Misunderstood, in the spring 2026 issue of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. If you've enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe, share, and explore more from the Dialogue Podcast Network. Until next time.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.